Welcome to the ODI Monthly Podcast, bringing you the views on the news from the Overseas Development Institute. This month, we explore rising numbers of overweight and obese people, find out what's going on in South Sudan, and talk 2015 with UNDP Administrator Helen Clark. ODI researchers recently carried out an assessment of the world's diets. It revealed that one in three adults worldwide are now overweight or obese, and that the developing world in particular has seen a significant expansion of its collective waistline. I asked ODI's Shereda Keats why this is such a problem.
Income is definitely a big contributing factor. As people get wealthier, they can eat more foods that perhaps they didn't have access to before, richer foods, higher in oils and fats and all these things that we like. If you think about, you know, a typical meal might change from a very poor person eating a bowl of steamed rice with a little bit of fish and veg on the side to, you know, a big bowl of fried rice with a quarter of a fried chicken on the side. So these are the sort of changes in meals that we're seeing. And together with this, there is a shift towards people being more sedentary. So we're not getting as much activity as we were just because our lifestyles are changing. And these factors are sort of combining to bring about these changes in health outcomes that we're seeing.
But according to Tim Lang of the Center for Food Policy at City University, it is a wider cultural problem, reflected by an out-of-control food supply.
This is a slow-burning fuse. Use whatever metaphor you like. But this is not a new problem. It's accelerating, however. Worries us in public health and worries us about the food economy is actually, even though the problem is well documented, even though there is a plethora of facts and evidence, there is an apparent inability by policymakers, by the food industry, really to tackle it. Now, you either say this is because of a conspiracy, they don't want to, or you say it's so complex they don't know what to do, or you say they want it, actually. This is a good sign. People getting fatter is progress. That's what all civilization has wanted. We've wanted to have a world of abundance. We've got it. Take the consequences. The great thing about the ODI report is it smashes that last position. It says this is nonsense. Countries cannot afford. Britain, a rich country, the USA, actually can't afford to have this obesity problem at the moment. I think we're now in the situation of having to face that policymakers really don't quite know how to address the complexity. The food supply is, in that sense, out of control. The environment we're in sends all the signals, don't waste energy, don't burn fuel. Don't burn food. Food is fuel. And that mismatch is actually now a problem. And yet politicians can't deal with that because this is the world they've tried to create. This is the world the food scientists of the 1920s and 30s wanted. This is the world the public health wanted. Public health people want to develop this world. So that is a complex situation.
And so what advice should we be giving to developing countries?
Well, let's think developing world. This sounds odd. From the sixth richest country in the world, don't go the route we've gone. Stick to simple diets. Stick to plant-based diets. Be wary of going the highly processed foods route. Be wary of sugar. Be wary of excess fats. Be wary of the rising, accelerating use of meat. Even vegetarian India has now gone down that route. It's not eating the animals, some Indians clearly, some Asians clearly, but in some religions which won't allow meat to be eaten, they're still eating vast amounts of milk. And so they have huge cattle herds. This is a land use problem. This is an ecosystems problem, not just a public health problem. My argument, my friend and colleague Jeff Rayner and I have articulated our analysis, is for the developing world, look upon obesity as the direction you don't want to go. And yet you're already there. You're not nearly as far as the United States or Britain, Northern Europe, but you're on that road. Think very carefully. Change it. Appeal to culture in a different way. Aim for simplicity. Don't go the car route of physical activity. Retain town planning, city planning as a place to take exercise. In a world of slums, that may sound odd that I'm saying that. Develop public transport infrastructure, not car infrastructure. encourage mobility of ideas, but not mobility through fossil fuel dependency, because that becomes a land use issue and that becomes a public health issue. This is about a model of progress. It's a philosophical and political point. Obesity is a warning signal to the world. Think differently about what we aspire to.
So what needs to be done?
My own view is quite sober, actually, because it follows, I hope I'm being intellectually consistent, that follows from our analysis here at the Centre for Food Policy that this is multisectoral, multi-level, and multifactorial. That's our conclusion of our review of the data and the thinking about policy. We can't therefore look for single solutions. I think we're in a process of experimentation. I've called it a process of democratic experimentation. The Danish Fat Tax was brought in, was undermined, lots of lessons to be learned, which have been learned and thought about. Mexico, I think, is doing something interesting at the moment. But actually, at the ODI seminar, I was saying, look, this is a cultural problem. If you just see it as something can be dealt with by price fixing, that's, if you like, the agricultural economy's dream. They always think it's about prices. This isn't, actually. Prices is part of it. Of course, sugar is cheap. Fats are cheap in the Western world. Making them more expensive can be quite useful, but then you're setting up contrary cultural signals. You've got to think of the cultural messages. And that's why Jeff Rayner and I, in our paper, we mapped out the multi-level, multi-sectoral approach that we think is necessary. And the argument is, if we want to do anything, don't do one thing at a time. It's got to be multiple at the same time.
It's a tricky task, but according to Shereda Keats, there is grounds for optimism.
Well, we do hear a lot about globalization of diets, and there is a sort of idea that everyone's converging on eating in a certain way that's very, very heavily processed foods, a lot of Big Macs, et cetera, et cetera. But what we have seen, and just from looking at a national level data, which is already an aggregate, so it's already not as diverse as it would be if we looked at a subnational level, we do see a massive amount of variation in diets, which really gives us a lot of hope in terms of there being ways to perhaps influence diets to move in a healthier direction, and that this move from sort of 1 in 3 adults to 2 in 3 adults being overweight or obese is not inevitable, and it's something that we should really think about trying to combat now.
Whichever way you look at the Future Diets report, it gives plenty of food for thought. What's going on in South Sudan? The world's newest nation saw violence flare up in the capital Juba just before the turn of the year. By late January, a ceasefire had been agreed. I spoke to James Copnell and Dame Rosalind Marsden, former EU Special Representative for Sudan and South Sudan, to find out more about what's taken place. I began by asking James Copnell, whose forthcoming book explores the political failings which threaten the future of both countries, whether it was fair to describe the events which triggered the violence as an attempted coup.
Well, that's President Salva Kiir's position, that this was an attempted coup by not just Riek Machar, who's now the rebel leader, but also several other senior political figures, Riek Machar's political allies. I don't think we've seen enough evidence for that yet. It may have been the case, but certainly we haven't been given the pieces that would allow us to make that conclusion. There certainly seems to have been fighting amongst the presidential guard, people loyal to Riek Machar and people loyal to Salva Kiir, but we haven't seen any evidence of a detailed plan to overthrow the president.
And is it fair to describe the recent violence as either ethnic or political?
Well, it's got many dimensions, but at the beginning it was a political squabble within the governing SPLM party. Opposition to Salva Kiir, the president, portrayed him as increasingly authoritarian, and there were several people, including Riek Machar, who wanted to replace him. They felt they didn't have the democratic space to do so. And then we had the events of the attempted coup, or the alleged attempted coup, on December the 15th. So there was quite clearly a political basis, trigger, for all this fighting. It has taken on some ethnic dimensions, particularly between parts of the Nuer community and parts of the Dinka community. Salva Kiir being a Dinka and Riek Machar being a Nuer. But that by no means explains the whole conflict. It's not true to say that all Nuers support Riek Machar, for example. The foreign minister and the head of the army are both Nuer but support Salva Kiir, and likewise Riek Machar has Dinka supporters too. That said, there has been, I think, killings committed by both sides along ethnic lines, and that's something that's dividing communities in South Sudan. But it's certainly not the only explanation, or even necessarily the major explanation, for what's happening.
Following the recent ceasefire in South Sudan, I spoke to Rosalind Marsden via Skype to find out how the ceasefire was negotiated and discuss the prospects for a lasting peace in the country.
Rosalind, could you begin by explaining for us a little bit about how this ceasefire came about?
The cessation of hostilities, which was agreed by the parties in Addis Ababa on the 23rd of January, essentially it was an agreement to immediately stop the fighting and to freeze their positions and also to set up a monitoring and verification mechanism. And it came about due to a combination of factors, I think. Firstly, there was the military situation on the ground. The government forces had succeeded in the period running up to the signing of this agreement. They'd succeeded in retaking the major towns. So they felt comfortable about signing a cessation of hostilities at that point. While on the other side, Riek Machar, the leader of the opposition faction, I think he was feeling squeezed and perhaps felt that he didn't have a lot of sort of military options left any longer. So I think that was one sort of reason. And then secondly, of course, it was also thanks to what seems to have been very strong and concerted international pressure, primarily from the IGAD mediation, who have, I think, have been very persistent and deserve a lot of credit for getting this agreement, but also with strong support from the United Nations, African Union, the Troika, the United States, UK and Norway, the European Union and China.
And what do you think are the chances of this ceasefire becoming a durable peace?
I think two points here. I think that military logic suggests that this cessation of hostilities has a reasonable chance of holding, for the very reason that the government is now holding all the major towns and the opposition forces appear not to have the military strength to attack and hold towns. So although we may see further incidents of violations of the cessation of hostilities, they perhaps are likely to be more of a sort of low intensity kind. And indeed, in the last 6 days since the agreement was signed, there have been reports of some violations. I think as of yesterday, the United Nations was reporting sporadic violence in parts of Unity and Upper Nile states, where most of the fighting has taken place over the last over the previous month. But this points to the vital importance of getting a verification and monitoring mechanism up and running as soon as possible. And I understand this is something that IGAD, the IGAD mediation, are now working on very urgently. In addition, of course, to the military importance of both parties seeing that there's an effective verification and monitoring mechanism in place, I think it's also important as a confidence building measure to create a conducive environment for political talks.
And just finally, could I ask what now needs to be resolved as a part of those political talks?
Well, the cessation of hostilities, which has been agreed, is just a first step. It seems to me that IGAD have bought themselves some time now to try to get a political process going. But it would appear that relatively little progress has been made so far on the future political process. We've heard that political talks are scheduled to start again in Addis Ababa on the 7th of February. And first of all, the parties will need to agree on an agenda for those talks, which one would imagine would need to cover things like the constitutional review process, the need for national reconciliation, security sector reform, and so forth. But it's also not yet clear to what extent the SPLM political leaders, the 11 leaders who've been detained in Juba throughout the crisis, to what extent they will be able to play a role. We've just heard that some of the 11 political detainees have now been released on bail, but I see that there are reports that others may be charged with planning a coup, so it's not quite clear what will happen on that front. But there was a second agreement that was signed in Addis on the 23rd of January on the status of detainees. It seems that many of the provisions of that agreement were cast in very general language, but there does seem to have been a broad acknowledgement of the need for an all-inclusive dialogue to resolve the issues that are connected with the current crisis in South Sudan, and in particular, the need to establish an all-inclusive national reconciliation process in which the detainees, but also other political actors and civil society, traditional religious leaders and others would also have to play a significant role. So I think that's important that that's been agreed, but there is no concrete roadmap at this point. So there is still a lot of work to be done on getting a concrete framework and a concrete agenda for the political process. So that is now, along with setting up the verification and monitoring mechanism, I think the key priority.
And finally, what about suggestions that the international community got carried away with South Sudan's progress as an independent state? Is that an assessment that deserves any sympathy?
What I would say is that from my experience of working with the European Union over the last 3 years is that the EU, and I think also EU member states like the UK, also the United States, focused the majority of their development assistance on areas such as primary education, healthcare, basic services, food security, support for small farmers, and some support for institutions like the judiciary. In the case of the UK, there was also support for the security sector reform, and the Americans were also involved in that. So I think what we've seen is that in addition to this support for state building, what was also necessary was to see more progress on nation building, taking account of the fact that South Sudan has just emerged from decades of very violent conflict and civil war, and that the wounds and the trauma of the past, particularly of the 1990s, has not really that hasn't been addressed. But I think the primary responsibility for initiating the nation building efforts has to come from the government and the South Sudanese leadership themselves.
The Millennium Development Goals are due to expire in 2015. I sat down with Helen Clark, the woman responsible for renewing the goals, to find out what we can expect.
Helen, thank you for talking to me. Talking about the Millennium Development Goals, almost the architecture of efforts to reduce poverty in the world. Those goals are up for renewal, or some people would say they're up for being rewritten. How far are we going with rewriting or renewing the goals, and do we need to change them?
I think there is a bigger, bolder, more transformational agenda in the making. The MDGs have been extremely important for galvanising global action around a set of priorities. I think it's more than just MDG Plus. I think the agreement last September at the leader level meeting at the General Assembly in New York that it should be a unified and universal agenda means that there's something for all countries, developing and developed, in this agenda. And if it's to be a truly sustainable development agenda, then the way in which we develop, the way in which we produce and consume is very much a focus area for these goals, and ensuring that we can keep lifting human development while maintaining the important ecosystem balance of the planet.
The 1 Million Voices consultation is an extremely impressive achievement, being able to find out what people all across the world want to improve their lives. It brings across a real sense of people's desire to improve their lives. Do we think we can meet their expectations with this process?
Expectations will be high. And there may also be a tendency for people to say, well, what did the MDGs do for me? If you're in the half that was lifted out of extreme poverty, as extreme poverty did reach its target of being halved, that's a great thing. But if you're in the other half, they'll be saying, well, what about me? And that's why with the new set of goals, bolder and more transformational as they must be, there is unfinished business from the MDGs, and we can't let go of that. Not every child is in school yet. Not every child in school is completing school. Not every child is able to go into secondary school. There are many areas where you can see where the MDGs need to develop to within this broader sustainable development agenda.
And what do you think are the new emergent issues that this renewal of the Millennium Development Goals will bring about?
I think a much greater sense of the interrelationship of people and planet, that the traditional form of development, which has been very heavy on the environment, is not sustainable. It's led to catastrophic loss of the world's forests, which has become a huge issue. It has caused pollution, ecosystem damage of all kinds. People want to be able to breathe the air. They want to be able to drink the water. They want a life that's not destroyed by the toxins that we surround ourselves with. So it has to be a different sort of development. But that is something that even developed countries find the upfront costs of quite onerous. So the upfront costs for a poor country are difficult. So there will be an ongoing need for international development cooperation to make it possible to shift to the sustainable development trajectory, which is capable of lifting human development.
And some of these challenges are really quite tricky. Bringing climate change, which is seen as a separate sphere in many senses, even within the UN, it has many separate processes to development processes. Bringing those two together will be difficult. And trying to tackle issues like war and conflict with a series of goals, some people might say that that's expecting too much. How practically do you think we can use this process to address those really tricky challenges?
Addressing climate change is a subset of what's needed to advance sustainable development. There's nothing that's done in adaptation and mitigation that isn't relevant to sustainable development. It's adaptation helps reduce risk to disaster and adverse impacts of climate. It's critical. Critical for poor people in the Sahel, actually critical for people in low-lying parts of the United Kingdom. It's a development issue. If you don't have resilience to what's happening to the climate, then your development will suffer. You will go backwards. Similarly with mitigation, supporting countries onto a clean energy path, for example, is going to be extremely important, because if we try to power the needs of 9 billion people by 2050 to the extent we power with coal now, this is tragic for the planet. So there have to be new ways. Now, peace and security has to come into the frame, because it is idle rhetoric to talk about eradicating extreme poverty by 2030 if it's not eradicated in South Sudan, Mali, Central African Republic, Afghanistan, all of which share a characteristic of being in the throes of, or having recently emerged from the throes of, extreme conflict. War de-develops. So what conversation do we need to have about how to support countries to rise out of the issues which have driven that conflict? And I think for development actors, that means a focus on what is driving these conflicts and how could we helpfully support countries to resolve those issues.
Okay, and one of the things that many people talk about when they talk about the success of the MDGs alongside reaching targets is the way in which they mobilised finance to help support development efforts. If we're going through a process of rewriting them, presumably a different finance agreement needs to be made. So who is going to pay for the next set of Millennium Development Goals?
I think there's diverse sources of funding. One is clearly the traditional role of official development assistance. And at a time when many Western economies have been under severe strain, it's been difficult to keep that up. It's slipped the last 2 years. But there are official development assistance is a small part now of what finances development. Countries' own domestic resources are of growing importance as countries grow and develop. They're generating more of their own money for health, education, infrastructure, and so on. Then there's the issue of loan finance. Maybe concessional from a development bank, it may be private finance, but you need capacities to access finance and to service it. So those capacities need to be grown and developed. Then there's the support that comes through trade. Again, building the capacity to trade is critical. There's the finance that comes from migrants being able to remit money back home. And again, looking rather more rationally at the world's labour markets and where we're short of labour but still tend to keep big gates around countries, you know, a more rational approach to migration will be good for both receiving country and source country. And remittances are a very important source of finance for family and community level development in many countries.
And just finally, ambitions are very high for the next set of Millennium Development Goals. Expectations for some people are high as well. You're in charge of stewarding this process. And can I ask what for you is the yardstick of success? How will we know that this process has been successful when an agreement is reached in 2015 and as it's implemented beyond 2015?
I'm rather optimistic because of the tone and content of the leaders' statement from last September in New York. It was an ambitious statement. It did talk about the next agenda needing to promote peace and security, the rule of law, democratic governance, human rights, gender equality. So I think the issue now is to holding on to that statement, to work with and alongside the Open Working Group, and I think civil society needs to stay very engaged with all these processes, to make sure that the agenda lives up to these expectations. With goodwill it can. There'll be a lot of negotiation for sure, although that's not due to start on the exact framework until the latter part of this year. But meantime, with the open working group processes, very seriously looking at a lot of the big themes, I think we need to keep that spirit that this matters, that this will set priorities for the next 15 years. It will galvanise action and resources. What goes in matters. It needs to be prioritised, needs to be focused, but we can come out with something very worthwhile.
But how well do Ms Clark's comments match up to the expectations of civil society? I asked Helen Dennis, co-chair of the Beyond 2015 campaign group, a similar set of questions so that you can decide for yourself. Helen, the Millennium Development Goals are essentially the architecture of global efforts to reduce poverty. What are some of the big issues that are being discussed at the moment? If you're trying to have an integrated development agenda for the modern world, presumably there are things like climate change, for example, that are being talked about much more seriously than they were before.
Yes, definitely. And Beyond 2015 as a global campaign has identified a number of different areas. So environmental sustainability being one of those. Within that, I think also a discussion around disaster risk reduction. We just look at Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines and look at how that has impeded or will hold back development. And we know that that's a core area. The whole question of inequality is massively upfront in the discussions. The MDGs arguably were about averages, and you could go for maybe the lowest hanging fruit. Whereas actually we want an agenda which takes marginalisation, exclusion seriously. And the narrative that was put forward by the high-level panel on this agenda around leave no one behind does part of that job. And Beyond 2015 wants to see a kind of more ambitious approach to inequality, gender equality, but beyond that as well. And then there are some other issues around human rights, around peace and security, which I think also need to be considered within this new framework.
And just before I ask my final question, can you explain to me a little bit about what civil society is doing at the moment to influence this process and what people can do to support civil society in influencing this process?
Yeah, there's been a huge amount going on and a huge amount of interest and a real sense and desire to have ownership over this new framework. And there have been a number of official consultation processes led by UNDP and others that civil society have been able to take part in at a national level. And there is also the work that's been done through the My World survey, which has brought together a huge number of voices looking at priorities for development going forward. Beyond 2015 has tried to build the capacity of civil society organisations at a national level through national hubs, through embarking on its own consultations, 40 consultations globally. And in the UK, the Beyond 2015 UK campaign has got over 100 organisations now involved and calling for an ambitious development agenda. So all in all, I think there's a huge amount going on. I think we need to maybe increase the visibility of some of the civil society inputs and work that has taken place to date. And as we get closer towards the September 2015 summit, really increase the volume, turn up the volume in calling for something which is really high ambition.
And just finally, when we look back on the post-2015 discussions and the new agreement is agreed and we move forward to implementation, at what point will we be able to tell whether this has been a successful process or not?
I think it's going to take quite a long time, actually, for whatever is agreed at global level to translate down into national development plans and into local realities. I mean, I think what you want to have is a sense that there is strong global awareness of this framework. I think Jeffrey Sachs talks about children being able to recite the new goals, but within the consciousness of citizens across every country, there is an understanding that there is this global development framework. It sets a standard of what people should be expecting from their governments. So I think that's important, the public consciousness. And then I think actually the reality of whether there is delivery at a local level based on these global goals and targets, and maybe national targets as well, will be the measure of whether or not we've succeeded.
Thank you for listening to the ODI Monthly Podcast. If you want more information on the topics discussed in this month's podcast, you can take a look at the related links section of the ODI Podcast webpage. If you want to get in touch, drop us a line on media@odi.org.uk. If you've enjoyed listening, why not subscribe to the monthly podcast using iTunes or Audioboo? Thanks for listening.